The odds of us having the high order universe, the low entropy that we have in our universe at the Big Bang by pure chance is the same as a monkey typing the entire corpus of Shakespeare perfectly by random tapping of the keys in a single trot.
Ave Maria Mutual Funds, seeking the moral high ground for 20 years. Pro-life, pro-family, and Catholic values have guided us to the top.
Are you looking for a comfortable brown scapular that won't break? Check out our sponsor, Scapulars.com. They use American-made paracord, so it's super strong. And they also use Australian merino wool, so it's super comfortable. It feels like you're getting a warm hug from your heavenly mother. Click on the link above or below in the description and get yourself the most durable, comfortable scapulars in the world. Hey, thanks for joining us today on our Reason for Hope. I just found out the other day from one of our producers that, you know, more than half the people that watch this show, this podcast, do not subscribe to us. This is insane. I mean, what are you waiting for? Hit the subscribe button now. All right, back to the show.
Hello, I'm Dr. David Hyduk, the Director of Theology at A Ray of Hope, and welcome to A Reason for Hope podcast. Our guest today is very exciting. We're so grateful to have him with us. He's a remarkable voice on the intersection of faith, science, philosophy, and culture, Father Robert Spitzer. He's a Jesuit priest, philosopher, physicist, and former president of Gonzaga University. He's the president of the Magis Center, dedicated to demonstrating the compatibility of faith and reason, particularly in the context of contemporary physics and philosophy. Father Spitzer has authored numerous scholarly and popular works on topics such as philosophical evidence for God's existence, the rational foundations of moral truth, the nature of human happiness, and most recently, a compilation of some of his answers to life's biggest questions. His intellectual contributions have made a significant impact in both academic and popular Catholic circles, and we're so honored to have you with us today, Father. Welcome.
Great to be with you again, Doctor.
So I want to jump right in, Father. I remember a very interesting book that you wrote, and I loved reading it, about new arguments for God's existence from contemporary physics and philosophy. And I was wondering if you could share with us a bit what you think are some of the most compelling new ideas, both in physics and philosophy, that you found really resonate with people regarding the existence of God. I think that, you know, the new atheists had their way for a while, and for weal or for woe, and yet new discoveries have seemed to put to bed some of the arguments that they were making. So what would you say are some of the most important ones for our listeners and viewers to know?
Yes, well, I'll start with the science. So from the vantage point of physics, we can see three big developments that pertain to what's called the beginning of physical reality. The Bohr of Lincoln and Guth theorem, or the Bohr of Lincoln and Guth proof, actually shows that every single cosmic system, whether it be a multiverse, an oscillating universe, like a bouncing universe, expanding and contracting, even a string universe in the higher dimensional space of string theory, certainly our universe, any of those systems is going to have a beginning in the finite past. And so because of this, there was really only one alternative, and that was what was called eternal inflation. Stephen Hawking and his partner Thomas Hertog, also the great string theorist Thomas Banks, have pretty much shut the eternal inflation option down, and the infinite multiverse went along with it. So today, science is really pointing to a beginning of physical reality, whether a physical reality be a multiverse, a string universe, a bouncing universe, etc. There's probably a strong likelihood, because of the preponderance of evidence, of a beginning. So what does a beginning mean in physics? Three easy points. Number one, if prior to the beginning, physical reality, whether it was a multiverse, string universe, just our universe, prior to the beginning, physical reality was nothing. And number two, if nothing can only do nothing, we're not going to sneak something into nothing, but if nothing can only do nothing, then point number three, then prior to the beginning, when physical reality was nothing and could only do nothing, something else, something which transcends physical reality itself, would have to move physical reality from nothing to something. Because when it was nothing, it could have never moved itself from nothing to something. Therefore, something else will have to move it from nothing to something. And that something else will have to be trans-universal, trans-physical space-time. In other words, beyond physical space and time, beyond the physical universe, beyond mass energy, beyond even the multiverse. It would have to be something that could be beyond all of physical reality and at the same time have the power to create ex nihilo out of nothing. That's a big development in physics. The fine-tuning argument has also really skyrocketed ahead as well. And so here, as I said, you know, the eternal inflation hypothesis was put to bed by in 2018 by Stephen Hawking, Thomas Hertog, slightly before that by Thomas Banks. But what Hawking and Hertog discovered was that a multiverse, if one did exist, not only would it, you know, it would have to be a very short duration. It couldn't have a long duration of inflation. And because of that, any multiverse that could generate our universe would only be capable of having a few bubble universes in it. So a multiverse is a gigantic super universe that is coughing out kind of little bubble universes. You know, typically, you know, it would be postulated as trillions upon trillions of bubble universes, one of which is our own, which is fit for life. But now, with Stephen Hawking's discoveries from LISA and LIGO, those two gravitational wave detectors, what seems to be the case now, for, as I said, for Hawking, for Hertog, for Banks, is that looks like there can only be a very small number of bubble universes. So let's just say a small number is a trillion trillion, just for the sake of having a really large small number, a trillion trillion bubble universes. Well, all of the various fine-tuning coincidences of physics today require far more than a little trillion trillion bubble universes to be explained by a multiverse. Let me give you a couple of examples. For example, we have very low entropy in our universe. Low entropy means high order, right? High order, it enables a system to have what we call net macroscopic flows of energy and matter. That's what causes change. That's what causes physical action in a system, right? It enables a physical system to do something. Well, according to, you know, the second law of thermodynamics, every time a system, a physical system, does some work, it loses a little bit of its order, and we call that entropy. And so it becomes a little more disordered. Now, you only can have a finite amount of order in a physical system. There's a very good reason for that, which I won't go into right now. But given that fact, you can probably say not only that high order, you can see that if the physical system is winding down, and that's what entropy means. Every physical system is going to wind down until it goes to inactivity, nothing, no macroscopic flows of energy or matter. So what does that mean? A dead universe? Well, we don't have a dead universe. The first thing that means is, well, then, wow, the universe has only been around for a very finite amount of time. That's true. But what's even stranger about our universe is it's lavish. It's huge. It's got all kinds of space. And that space is filled with order everywhere. So the high order of our universe at the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, the order of our universe would have been, you know, we may say the low entropy of our universe was so spectacularly low in entropy, high in order, that Roger Penrose, a very famous physicist at Oxford, calculated the odds of this occurring, this high order universe, as 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 123 to 1 against. So this is like saying, it's a double exponent, right? And so it's like saying if every single zero in that number, if you wrote it out completely, you know, our universe could not hold that number if every single zero were 10 points high. So what does that mean? That means that the odds of us having the high order universe, the low entropy that we have in our universe at the Big Bang by pure chance is the same as a monkey typing the entire corpus of Shakespeare perfectly by random tapping of the keys in a single trunk. In other words, virtually impossible in any scenario. Well, what do you think? A couple trillion? Bubble universe is going to make any difference to that number? 10 to the 123 divided by a trillion, and go out a trillion times. It's still going to be just about 10 to the 123. That number is so huge in its proportions. So how can we possibly explain that, common sense way? Well, the low entropy of our universe is not going to be explained by a multiverse. There's just simply not enough bubble universes to even come close. So how are we going to explain it? Multiverse won't work. Pure chance is out of the question. String universe and higher dimensional space, string theory is not going to work. You'll never get that number of universes coughed out of it in a finite amount of time. So what are we left with? A designer, a very, very intelligent designer that has literally manufactured this high order, low entropy universe right at the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. That's where science is pointing today. I mean, the same thing with you look at the cosmological constant in our universe. That's the cosmological constant determines the acceleration of our universe out of its singularity condition at the Big Bang, right? So there was a certain acceleration, dark energy and so forth, that pushed our universe out, enabled it to overcome the gravitational force and to move out and expand as it is doing today, even accelerating in its expansion as it is doing today. Well, that cosmological constant, in order for our universe to sustain life, it's got to be fine-tuned to within one part in 10 to the 120th. That's a trillion, 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 trillion. One part in a trillion, 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 trillion. You look at that and you go, what are the odds of this happening? Virtually impossible by pure chance, right? That's just not going to happen that this fine tuning is. But yet, if we didn't have that, then either our universe would be expanding so rapidly, it would have never gathered into galaxies, galactic systems and planets and birds and so forth. And of course, at the very same time, if it had been just a tad off in the other direction, our universe would have collapsed into a black hole. And so you look at that and you think to yourself, wow, you mean we averted complete cosmological disaster for life forms by one part in a trillion? Yes, we did. Now, do you think this is going to happen with a multiverse that has a couple of trillion universes, bubble universes in it? No, that's not going to happen.
Well, it's sort of funny, Father, because I remember very, very distinctly that the argument, sometimes this was, people would riff on Carl Sagan to bring this argument about, was almost like, you know, with how big the universe is, it was almost inevitable there would be an Earth, you know, like, and it seems to what you're saying that actually, no, when we consider what contemporary science is saying, that it's not inevitable. It's not, gee, everything's so big, so the chances are eventually you'd get us, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, so all the initial conditions and constants of our universe are, you know, literally designed it's so refined in its design that the odds of this occurring by pure chance are, like, as I said, one in a trillion, 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 all the time. And with entropy, it's just so much more than that. So it's all the initial conditions to get to a universe that will give rise to life in the first place. So, I mean, Carl Sagan, he didn't talk about the initial conditions in consciousness. All he talked about was, oh, you know, there's 10 to the 22, you know, stars in our universe. Well, that's true. There's a billion trillion stars in our universe. And there's 100 billion galaxies in our universe, too. So, you know, about 10 to the 11th, you know, 100 billion stars per galaxy, more or less. I mean, all that's true. But, you know, in order to get to that point, what you have to see is that all constants have to be in place. All the initial conditions have to be in place. And the odds of our initial conditions and constants having the precise values that they need to have within one part in a trillion, higher or lower, the odds of that happening are around 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 125th to 1 against. In other words, this is, it's like a monkey typing the entire corpus of English literature perfectly by random tapping.
Not just Shakespeare.
Yeah, this is not going to happen by pure chance. It's not going to happen by, you know, a multiverse, you know, which Stephen Hawking and Hertog and these guys are saying now can only have a small number of bubble universes. For all intents and purposes, we're looking right into the mind of God. I mean, a super intelligent designer. So I mean, I think Fred Hoyle's argument, you know, really comes into play, you know, perfectly, where he says, you know, he was actually specifically looking at the odds of carbon, and abundance of carbon occurring by pure chance in our universe, you know, and at the time, you know, the odds of that happening were somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 10, or you know, one part in 10 raised to about the 80th to 1 against. Well, if you look at that, again, you're dealing with a trillion. So, I mean, the odds against it are, as he said, the odds are the same as a tornado sweeping through a junkyard, assembling a Boeing 747 ready for flight. In other words, and his final comment, he just says, you know, when you look at the numbers that we're dealing with here, this is from the initial conditions and constants. When you look at the numbers with which we are dealing, you know, it's you know, and you rule out a multiverse because you don't ever have nearly enough bubble universes to explain it if the Hawking and Hertog conditions are correct, you know, for the generation of our universe, then basically, as he says, there must have been some super calculating, super intellect that has monkeyed with the constants of physics and the chemistry and biology as well. And he says, I consider this to be almost beyond question because, you know, as a, you know, the numbers are just so, you know, far stretching. You know, the former founding director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, Robert Jastrow, you know, he kind of put it in a nice little analogy. He said, well, you know, scientists unshackled themselves from the domain of conjecture and superstition and took on, you know, a methodology of rigorous verification through empirical mathematical method and ascended the cliffs of knowledge and came to the final precipice, pulled themselves over and found a band of theologians there awaiting them for centuries. So, I mean, that's where we are. And like I said, you know, when you really look at the developments that have been going on in physics, a little wonder, right, like 51% of physicists overall declare themselves to be believers in God or higher transcendent power. Only about 21% are agnostic and 20% are atheists. But if you look at the younger scientists, it's decidedly higher. The last Pew survey of the American Association for the Advancement of Science indicates that 66%, a supermajority of young scientists, declare themselves to be believers in God, with only about 15% declaring agnostic and 15% atheist. The doctors are out of sight. I mean, 76% declare themselves to be believers in God or a higher transcendent power, only 12.5% agnostic and 11.2% atheist. And two-thirds of those doctors actually practice their faith. So when you really start looking at it, it's amazing.
Pretty impressive. Listen, a quick question. So are you saying that, like, I remember that with regards to the Big Bang Theory, there was this idea of, like, an oscillating universe that was very, very popular, that the expansion was happening, and then there was going to be this almost implosion, you could say, or this constriction. And then, like you're saying, there's this idea, this maybe ever-expanding universe that now Hawking and his company have disproven. Is the oscillating universe, is all that still in the mix with regards to what some physicists hold? Or, you know, is there something you could speak to with regards to the Big Bang Theory?
Yeah, the oscillating universe was thought to be a real possibility about 20 years ago. But then after the discovery of the preponderance of what we call dark energy in our universe, the oscillating universe, the bouncing universe, really lost popularity. Let me explain. About 5% of our universe is what we call visible matter. And visible matter positively interacts with gravity, so it causes attraction. Then about five times more, about 25% of our universe is dark matter. Dark matter doesn't emanate any force it doesn't emanate any kind of electromagnetic force, any strong nuclear force or weak force. You won't be able to detect it in any way except through its interaction with the gravitational field. It's basically dark matter is what keeps our galaxy from flying apart. And then you get down to dark energy, which is the opposite of dark matter. So in other words, dark energy negatively interacts with the gravitational field. So inside the space-time field, dark energy causes not attraction, but repulsion. So it's causing an accelerating expansion of the universe as a whole. Well, now that we know that about 70% of our universe is composed of dark energy, it's pretty clear the preponderance there is going to mean that we're not going to have a bounce. The universe is not going to grind to a halt and then collapse in upon itself to re-expand again. And so that was pretty much ruled out. And starting about 20 years ago, bouncing universe really lost popularity. But even more, you know, than that, Sean Carroll really put a nail in the coffin. I mean, technically speaking, Sean Carroll would like no God to exist, but he's, you know, he constantly, you know, he's helping the theists out all the time, you know, but that's another story. But the main thing is what he showed with respect to the bouncing universe is, you know, for every single bounce that you postulate, you know, right now, remember what I was saying about low entropy being, you know, exceedingly, exceedingly improbable. Well, every time you go back a cycle, the entropy would have had to have been much lower in the previous cycle, which is even more improbable in the previous cycle. Until you finally, as Sean says, if you said, well, gosh, you had an infinite bouncing universe, then the universe would have started off literally with infinite high order. You know, in other words, infinite fine tuning, which, of course, could only be explained ultimately by God.
Right.
So, you know, whatever you choose, I mean, the bouncing universe, let's face facts, for about 10 reasons, nobody really holds it out as the big possibility anymore. They tried some string theory bouncing universes and some very nice esoteric bouncing universes like the Steinhardt-Turok proposal, things of that nature. But again, all of those things, the Bortle-Vilenkin and Guth theorem applied to them because those are expanding universal conditions. So today, to be honest with you, bouncing universes out even in string theory. String theory universes are out. Multiverses are too small to explain design. So now, to answer the question that Carl Sagan never looked at, namely the initial conditions and constants of our universe and how they got to be where they are, right? If the multiverse can't do the job, the string universe can't do it, the bouncing universe can't do it, well, there is a designer, a highly, highly intelligent designer.
That's right. So listen, I'd like to pivot a bit to talk about evolution and evolutionary theory, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
What does evolutionary theory state exactly? You know, like what is that? What is meant by theory there, I guess? Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I've heard this distinction between micro versus macro evolution. You know, do you mind getting into some of that and how a Catholic can hold these things?
I don't mind getting into it at all. But before I begin, though, just remember that, you know, since Pope Pius XII, let's face facts, you know, contemporary biblical criticism for, you know, not only Pope Pius XII, but Pope John Paul II and so forth, all of them hold that the Genesis text is not to be viewed as a scientific text.
Right.
It is not a text that's talking about an empirical mathematical explanation of our universe. Right. It is a metaphorical text. And, you know, as a metaphorical text, it is using symbols to talk about sacred truths necessary for salvation. There's one God. You know, everything else is a creation of the one God. So there's not a sea God and a mountain God and so forth. Those are all creations of the one God. You know, human beings are at the top, of the cycle. There's an order to evolution and so forth and so on. All those sacred truths necessary for salvation. Those, of course, Pope Pius XII would say, you know, they're the truths that the Bible's supposed to be giving. Right, the Bible's not giving scientific truths because scientific truths are not necessary for salvation. So you can look at them in the true metaphorical sense in which they were written. Now, let's just see what does evolutionary theory say. The evolutionary theory begins with 13.8 billion years ago. Right, our universe was created. Our particular galaxy was probably. Its inception about 11.7 billion years ago. And our star in our universe is 4.6 billion years old. And our Earth is about a little over 4.5 billion years old. Now, what we do have, fossil evidence of what we call very, very, primitive organelles preceding, a single cell organism like, a bacterium of one kind or another, a protozoa, a flagellum, whatever. So we do have these the precursors to single-celled organisms going back almost 4 billion years. So about 600,000 600 million years after our Earth was in a state of formation. So, like I said, we've been around 4.5 billion, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 500 million years ago. 500 million years from that time, about 4 billion years ago, we see a life beginning to evolve. Now, I have a book called Science, Reason, and Faith, Discovering the Bible, and I have that entire picture of evolution completely drawn out and the approximate dates at which every stage of evolution happened.
Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed with contrarian thinking. Their independent research and analysis provide a deep understanding of our investments with the intent to avoid or minimize unpleasant surprises. This helps to ensure that their funds' investments match your moral beliefs. The advisor invests in securities only if they meet the fund's investment and religious requirements, and as such, the return may be lower or higher than if the advisor made decisions solely based on investment considerations. The fund's method of security selection may or may not be successful, and the fund may underperform or outperform the stock market as a whole. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. For a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, charges, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, call 1-866-AVE-MARIA. That's 1-866-283-6274. Or visit the link above or below in the description. The Brown Scapular is a special Catholic devotional. Invest in a scapular that is as strong as your devotion. At scapulars.com, they use super strong American-made paracord because your scapular should be as strong as your devotion. They also use the finest Australian merino wool that feels like a warm hug from your Heavenly Mother. You'll also find handmade rosaries with our distinctive deliverance cross, Italian-made saint medals, keychains, and jewelry. Visit the link above or below in the description to get yourself one of the most durable, comfortable scapulars in the world. Hello, and thanks for being with us here on Arisa for Hope podcast. Been very grateful of the many years that we've been doing this for you. This is our sixth season with hundreds of podcasts already released. Although they're free to watch and listen to, they're not free to produce. So I'm asking that you discern to contributing and donate to A Reason for Hope podcast. We're a nonprofit organization. Every dollar, every penny is tax deductible. All you have to do is go to our website and click donation and navigate the podcast. All the funds that you donate will go to the production of this podcast. Thanks again, and may God bless you.
Father, do you mind me just asking, for the sake of our viewers, how the time on that is figured out by scientists today? Like, how do we know this many hundreds of billions of years ago, or whatever the case may be?
Mm-hmm. There are two ways of doing it. One way of doing it is fossil evidence. And there's two ways of looking at fossils. Stratigraphy, that's the layer in which they're found in the geological crust. And then, of course, by dating mechanisms. And there's several electrochemical dating tests that you can do that give you a pretty accurate notion of, you know, like, for example, you know, my brother is a collector of, you know, extremely old fossils. And of course, you can actually date the fossil core, you know, when these things actually were occurring. Now, these are, you know, very simple worm-like, simple animalic forms and things like that. But yes, you can date them by electrochemical methods. Stratigraphy is another method. By the way, the person who really put stratigraphy on the map was a Danish Catholic bishop Steno. Nicholas Steno, and he is the father of contemporary geology. Just a little aside. By the way, who came up with the Big Bang Theory, the first mathematical justification through the general theory of relativity, was another priest, too, Father Georges Lemaître, Monsignor Georges Lemaître, who did that. You know, he had a double PhD at MIT and was a colleague of Einstein's and Hubble's and did a fine job. But I'm getting, you know, beside my point here. The main thing to answer your question is, yes, we can figure out when those things actually occurred. We also can do that by going back. So you can see, you know, microevolution. You can actually see, the number of layers that, you know, and when you try and compare mitochondrial DNA to the actual DNA of various kinds of organisms, and you can make certain kinds of comparisons on your tables, you can pretty much see which comes ahead of which and how much time theoretically there is between the layers. Then you compare the layers with the fossil evidence from stratigraphy, the fossil evidence from electrochemical dating, and you finally get to the point where you get a pretty, you know, a reasonably accurate clue of, you know, just about when each of these stages occurred. Obviously, we know when our genetic ancestors occurred, pretty close to it. Our genetic ancestors are mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosome Adam. And the reason they're, mitochondrial Eve, every single one of us on this earth has the remnant of her mitochondrial DNA. So that's carried with us. So starting with her, to the present, and she lived 200,000 years ago. And again, you do that by going back in the layers, comparing DNA, you start comparing the layers against the mitochondrial DNA that she gave us. And you can get a pretty good idea. It was around 200,000 years ago. Similarly, we have a common male ancestor, and his name is Y chromosome Adam. And Y chromosome Adam, again, lived around 200,000 years ago. Every single male, and as much as we all have Y chromosomes, we have the remnant of his DNA. So those are our two genetic first parents. We know that they lived around 200,000 years ago. And some biologists push it out to, and geneticists push it out to 300,000 years. Some push it out to 150,000. But let's just say 200,000 years ago, plus or minus 50,000 years. All right. And then, but is that really our, absolute, what I would call ensouled ancestor? See, I'll be honest with you. For 140,000 years, so from 200,000 years ago to about 60,000 years ago, basically our genetic ancestors were sitting at the border of Angola and Namibia. They weren't doing a lot. Some primitive tools, a few other things, a kind of an advanced cave work, things like that. They weren't doing anything special. All of a sudden, 60,000 years ago, you've got the Great Leap Forward. And I mean, just there's almost universal agreement with this in the genetic and biological community. I mean, truly, 60,000 years ago, we see this, it's the most amazing thing. First, we see the mathematical counting sticks. It's like they appear out of nowhere. Then all of a sudden, you've got the Lamingo bone and so forth and so on. You've got three-columned, counting sticks that can be used for not only addition, but multiplying and aggregating in complex fashions. And what the heck, 60,000 years, mathematical, Homo Mathematicus suddenly comes into being. 60,000 years ago, we begin to see, that there is Homo aestheticus, right? We begin to see the bone flutes and the little harps that are made, out of string. Of course, the strings don't exist today, but we can see it in the grave goods of these people. All of a sudden, human beings, so they become Homo aestheticus. They're painting seashells with bright colors, and they're making figurines of lion heads and gods, and cave paintings start in earnest. Prior to, if you go like 70,000, 80,000 years ago, nothing, and then Homo religiosus. I mean, 60,000 years ago, you begin to see that human beings, very different from Neanderthals. Neanderthals buried their dead. But human beings 60,000 years ago start burying their dead with grave goods that could be used in an afterlife, showing great anticipatory self-consciousness, projecting themselves into an indefinite future where they might need some flame to help them out. And they might need some spears, and they might need other kinds of things, on their journey and so forth. Obviously, thinking there's going to be a journey after death, and food stores and things of that nature are buried with the bodies. This, of course, reveals that 60,000 years ago, there's this huge technological revolution where we, human beings not only have just primitive flints, they've got actual flints that they can carry around with them. They've got fishing hooks. They've got sewing needles. They've got technology for navigating through the stars. They've got, this huge technological breakthroughs on every single level. And of course, so you've got, then the geographical expansion. As I said, 69 years ago, what are human beings doing? Our genetic ancestors? Why? They're hanging around Angola, Namibia, but then suddenly, 60,000 years ago, they go zooming up to the northern coast of Africa. They go over the straits. They go to the west into Europe, and they start inhabiting various spots in Europe. They go to the east, and they go into the whole Asian area. They actually invent canoes and watercraft and navigation sufficient to get themselves down to Indonesia, where we find some of the earliest cave paintings 60,000 years ago are, in Sulawesi there and in Indonesia. And you say, well, wait a minute, these guys are crazy. And then, of course, the ones that go into Europe, They go all the way up to the northernmost parts of Europe, right, to Siberia. And literally, at that time, there was an Arctic land bridge. They cross the Arctic land bridge, and they go into the New World from the Arctic land bridge, go, you know, from the really the northern heights of Alaska today, all the way down to the southern tip of South America. And they do this in 20,000 years. 20,000 years. And they're everywhere present. The diversification of languages, the whole, you know, technological setup for, you know, even, you know, primitive kinds of irrigation and the planting of crops, the whole technological revolution, mathematics, morality, religion, you know, aesthetics, painting, and so forth, 60,000 years ago. I mean, when you look at it, all the transcendentals, our desire for perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and hope, you can see that somehow, you know, it's all there. I think our genetic ancestors for 140,000 years did not have a soul. And then, as Chomsky and Berwick indicate, probably in a single couple, about 60,000 years ago, they think, you know, a gene flipped. It was no gene that flipped. That didn't give mathematical consciousness sufficient to break the Gödelian incompleteness problem.
So let me just kind of jump in there for a second. So what I'm hearing from you is that whatever process took place where lower life forms are evolving into the multiplicity of different kinds of creatures that were created, eventually getting to this pre-human genetic ancestor, and then at some point, God would have chosen to infuse a soul into a first man and a first woman. Is that sort of like how you envision what would have taken place?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I do. I don't think it can be mathematically explained in that short of a period of time, right? I mean, how are you going to explain that in 4 billion years? Even the agnostic sort of panpsychist, Thomas Nagel doesn't believe that. I mean, he just thinks, you know, there's just no possible way you can explain that many adaptations that would have had to have occurred from a single-celled organism to a human being to explain that in 4 billion years is absolutely, 4 billion is not nearly enough.
This would be very consonant then with Pius XII in Humani Generis, where he talks about how, you know, the human body developing and coming from pre-existent matter, living matter, is one thing, but that the soul has to be directly created by God, for example.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And I don't think, honestly, the 7 major areas of development that happen in what's called the Great Leap Forward, right? The mathematical revolution, the linguistic revolution, where we start doing triadic, sentences, unlike any other animal or computer or anything else. The technological revolution that shows, obviously, abstract consciousness applied to real-world problems. The aesthetic revolution, the visual aesthetics, the musical aesthetics, etc., that come about. The religious revolution, homo religiosus, right? I mean, there's just, you know, no way. The geographical disposition, all of these things require an abstract consciousness, indeed self-consciousness plus abstract consciousness plus an awareness of the true, the good, the beautiful, of love, and of course spiritual religious consciousness. You would have to have all these things included in what I call the package that the soul would give. So once you have abstract capability, which you need a soul for, by the way, and I'm not the only guy, there's a lot of proofs why a soul is going to require processes beyond physical processes and structures, right?
Actually, Dr. Edward Faser has a new book called Immortal Souls, which is wonderful and touches upon this very point. So,
yeah, no, I think Ed Faser's right on the marker, and I think also, I have a book called The Soul's Upward Yearning, And as I said, I have a whole book called Science, Reason, Faith, Discovering the Bible. All these things, I really outlined, the problem in it.
So listen, in relation to this, and I love these questions. I hope you're okay with them because I get them a lot. So I'm really curious of your view. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, when it's talking about original sin, says that the church which has the mind of Christ knows very well that we cannot tamper with the revelation of original sin without undermining the mystery of Christ. I find this like a very, very interesting statement in the Catechism. So like, I think that this is the question, like, you know, notwithstanding what you said about the importance of taking the stories in Genesis, for example, in their proper historical setting, the type of literature that they are and the like. Nevertheless, we do have the view that like there was a prelapsarian, preternatural state of human beings, right? So like this idea that we had something that we lost, that went with this first act of disobedience.
There's no question about it. In other words, I certainly think it happened in one couple. As I said, I think God ensouled the first couple. And, you know, how he ensouled the next generation, I'm not sure. I do think that that the progeny of Adam and Eve might have mixed with other non-progeny of Adam and Eve, obviously. And if God wanted to give them a soul, fine. He would have certainly had to have given all subsequent generations a soul after that. So I think anything related to the line of Adam and Eve, he gave a soul. Now you say, well, how does that tamper with original sin? It doesn't, because I think Adam and Eve get a soul. They have a sense of themselves as eternal beings. They don't see themselves as dying or anything like that. They have an unobscured vision of God. I think they had an extremely strong vision of God. But then I truly believe the Genesis narrative, Satan was at their elbow right away. The minute that creature was created, Satan was there. It's almost like that, C.S. Lewis's trilogy there, the Paralandra trilogy. Satan comes on the scene. Mm-hmm. And of course, what is Satan going to do? He's going to do exactly what I think the Genesis narrative says. How that happened with this first insult, Adam and Eve, I do not know, but they had a sense that there were certain, you know, they had a conscience as an ensouled human being. They had a conscience, literally the voice of God speaking through them, just as we all have that voice of God speaking through our conscience. And so I don't know what happened, but I do know somehow something like self-idolatry or pride seems to be the good candidate that our scriptures have recommended, and I don't disagree. I think that the devil's idea of, hey, you know, look at that tree out there. Why do you think God didn't want you to have that? Well, you know, it'll make us like gods. Well, what's wrong with that? He's keeping it from you. He wants to be better than you. Yeah, you know, just try it out. Looks pretty good anyway. You know, and so I think they go for some kind of self-idolatrous, some kind of overweening pride, kind of a prize to, as it were, be unto gods themselves. Something along those lines.
So how does that, like the Catechism discusses what I usually refer to as the four shaloms that existed in the beginning, the perfect harmony that held sway within the human person, between man and woman, this would assume between human beings with all creation. So there's, and obviously between human beings and God. So how does that perfect harmony that holds sway in a prelapsarian state in which there are these preternatural gifts bestowed upon human beings work with an evolutionary framework that seems to be based in, you know, a lot of conflict, death, destruction, extinction, you know, and all that sort of thing. Like, so is there, how is that harmony with creation existing in that world?
Yeah, well, first of all, You know, when you're using the idea of death coming into the world, it's really death coming into the human being. I think the first ensouled human being viewed themselves as destined for eternal life. I think that's how, if you received a soul that was made in the image and likeness of God, that's the way you would view it. You'd think, but I mean, the idea that there was no physical death, you know, to other non-ensouled beings prior to Adam and Eve, well, that just can be scientifically disproven.
No, but that's what I mean. I'm not saying that that was the case. What I'm saying is that given that the whole evolutionary process seems to indicate that that's all part of the process, right? Then how is it that Adam and Eve are preserved in this state of perfect harmony with creation when it doesn't seem like creation's in harmony, so to speak? You get what I mean?
Yeah, they're the only ones that have a soul. I mean, in other words, they're the only ones that could possibly recognize the harmony to begin with. They're the only ones that could anticipate themselves as living forever to begin with. I mean, they're the only ones that could possibly, you know, have a sense of God, right? We don't notice any figurines or religious consciousness on the part of any of our hominid ancestors, including 140,000 years worth of our own genetic ancestors. We don't notice anything religious. Boy, 60,000 years ago, all of a sudden you see all kinds of gods and goddesses and fertility goddesses and all kinds of, you know, symbols of, you know, divine, you know, sensitivity and so forth and so on. Now you look at that and you go, okay, so this is a very different being, this this human being with the soul that anticipates itself as living. Now, all of a sudden they do something that jeopardizes, right? They disobey God. They violate their conscience. They darn well know that this is contrary to the will of the Creator, contrary to the voice of their conscience. They violate it, probably because of some self-idolatrous thing. Once that happens, then all of a sudden, literally, the eternally the being that was destined for eternity is going to get closure. There's, in other words, you're going to die now. And, you know, that first couple knows, you know, that whatever they conceived, right, of as being, you know, destined for eternity, that's going to come to closure. And so there, I think that's the kind of death that comes into the world, the self-reflective and souled recognition of what death is. Has come into the world when the anticipation of that ensouled creature was to live on in eternity. Now that crushing blow occurs.
So I'm thinking about the traditionally stated preternatural gifts, like immortality, but I think this was always thought to mean physical immortality, not just spiritual immortality. Impassibility, so no suffering, you know, like these sorts of infused knowledge and like, so do you still see those as possibilities within the framework?
Yes, because you have an ensouled creature that is destined for all these things, but it was all brought to ruin for that ensouled human being, because they certainly, that ensouled human being had the potential for eternal life.
I want to have one more, maybe more broad question, and then I'm going to get into talking about your latest book, Father. But the more broad question is this, you know, what would you say? Now, listen, I know what you said before about like the growth in an understanding of biblical criticism and all this stuff in the, let's say the 20th century, the 19th, 20th century, 21st century. But like, what would you say to somebody who said, well, okay, like, I get that the church has always talked about understanding the scripture, what the biblical authors were trying to communicate, all these sorts of things within the type of genre that it is, that we shouldn't read, you know, something that is not meant to be history or science as if it is. And maybe the Bible is not even talking about science at all. So we shouldn't look at it that way as a science textbook. I mean, I understand all that. So let me say all that, prefacing this question. What would you say to somebody who says, well, gee, but it seems to me that for the church's tradition, it understood these stories in a particular way. And now all of a sudden, because of contemporary findings in science, the church is changing her tune. Like, you know, the church is reinterpreting these stories in a way other than they've really been interpreted. Not that the church didn't also hold, obviously there has to be one God that he created from nothing. I mean, those things that we would still hold today. But I mean, in the finer points of these things, like there's an actual Eden, you know, like in all these sorts of things. What would you say to somebody who says, well, how can the church's understanding of something like this develop to such a degree that it's basically not holding what it held before to be what these stories are communicating in light of new biblical understandings and research?
So we read St. Augustine's De Genesi ad Literam. In other words, the first thing I would do is, you know, how does Augustine start off? He says, look, there are all kinds of natural philosophers out there that really do have a very good understanding of the earth, a very good understanding of the stars, a very good understanding of, you know, how, you know, biological, you know, processes to the best of our observational knowledge in 400 AD, you know, how these things work. And, you know, then they listen to Christians who are interpreting, you know, the narratives of Genesis, you know, in a way that is absolutely contrary to what they know to be, you know, obviously empirically verified processes. And what do? They laugh us to scorn. Mm-hmm. And so Augustine says, please, please do the church a favor. And do not do these things where you can clearly have the whole scientific community laughing Christianity to scorn. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, he wrote in 400 AD. Yeah, he did. That's exactly right. So way back then, St. Augustine recognized the problem. We're going to have an interpretation of Genesis that enables, you know, our own recognition of natural processes and things of that nature. We're going to have, you know, an interpretation of the word that is not going to deny either an empirical fact or something that is very close to an empirical fact, you know, and so, you know, St. Robert Bellarmine, you know, I just wish he had lived another 20 years. So, you know, there would have been no Galilean controversy if he had lived another 20 years. He had a very important principle that he says to his friend Foscarini. You know, Foscarini is really challenging him on, you know, geocentrism, which means Earth at the center of the solar system, and heliocentrism, the sun is at the center of the whole solar system. Now, the church never had any problem with that. I mean, it allowed Copernicus, who was a Catholic cleric, to give the first mathematical justification of heliocentrism. So the church wasn't against science or heliocentrism. That wasn't the real problem. But what Bellarmine said to Foscarini was this. He said, you know, I'm going to stick with geocentrism until such time as there is a scientific demonstration that of heliocentrism, that the sun is at the center and the earth and the other planets are orbiting around it. And so he says, if there is such a scientific demonstration and it is clearly correct and can, you know, it can be verified by, you know, Christian, non-Christian alike, if that is the case, then we have to find an interpretation of Scripture that is consistent with that fact. We cannot be saying that Scripture is dictating how science and natural philosophy should proceed. Alternatively, it says, Bellarmine, for right now, I don't see the scientific demonstration. In fact, we didn't have a scientific demonstration until 1830 when Bessel actually did use stellar parallax to show, you know, the heliocentrism had to be true. And at that point, the church accepted that fact and interpreted Genesis accordingly.
Father, and notwithstanding, just for the sake of our viewers, you know, like notwithstanding that there was probably enough ill treatment to go around, whether in the Galileo controversy, certainly maybe some actors in the church were unjust in their treatment of Galileo. Galileo himself was a difficult character, people aren't aware that like the church actually funded Galileo's work. You know, like, I mean, there was, it wasn't like the church was anti-science as they make that controversy to be. So
in fact, the Pope was very pro-science and pro-mathematics.
But I mean, he didn't have the backing. That's the thing. Like, Galileo's viewpoint was in the scientific minority. As you say, it wasn't until much later that they had the mathematical backing for what Galileo was saying. So
that's correct. But also, remember, the Pope didn't ask Galileo not to believe in heliocentrism. He said to Galileo, do not publish this as a fact until there is adequate scientific demonstration. That's what he asked. Galileo agreed to that. Then he turned right around, and then the two new world systems went ahead and published it as a fact. And so that got the Pope mad. But, you know, the fact is, when the tribunal kind of declared it to be kind of a heresy, that probably, as John Paul II said, that probably went too far, because, you know, we didn't know which scriptural interpretation was right. So Galileo shouldn't have been, you know, declared kind of a heretic for, you know, interpreting scripture wrongly. He was guilty, though, of definitely publishing as a fact what was not known, and for which there would not be any evidence for over 100 years of heliocentrism. So he was guilty of something. But to say that, you know, he was kind of a heretic was that probably pushed the limits. But John Paul II apologized for it. He just basically said, well, the tribunal went too far, and that's why I think if Bellarmine had lived, you know, I don't think the tribunal would have done that. I think they would have all waited. Let's just wait. And Galileo, you have to take back this statement that this is a fact, because it's not a fact. And, you know, but we're not going to declare that you have violated Catholic doctrine, you know, and so forth. But, you know, so there were wrongs on both sides. But you're right, Galileo, he was a very arrogant character. And, he even called the Pope Simplicius in the two New World systems, you know, which was like calling him a dummy, a simpleton. So, I mean, again, the guy was not diplomatic. He was very arrogant. And, you know, the Jesuits who had supported at the Roman College so much of Galileo's research and actually were part of the sources that he used for his research and tides and all of that to come to his conclusion regarding gravity, all that stuff. The Jesuits were really pro-Galileo. And then when they saw, what he had done, the Jesuits were liberally minded people just said, you know, Galileo, I don't think you can be our friend anymore. it's like you're too hot to handle. You know, and you're basically too full of yourself.
Father, I have this great quote. This comes from Leo XIII, but he winds up quoting Augustine. I think, this goes along the lines of what you were saying about Augustine. There can never indeed be any real discrepancy between the theologian and the physicist as long as each confines himself within his own lines and both are careful, as St. Augustine warns us, quote, not to make rash assertions or to assert what is not known as known, quote. If dissension should arise between them, here is the rule also laid down by St. Augustine for the theologian, quote, whatever they can really demonstrate to be true of physical nature, we must show to be capable of reconciliation with our scriptures. And whatever they assert in their treatises, which is contrary to these scriptures of ours, that is to Catholic faith, we must either prove it as well as we can to be entirely false, or at all events, we must, without the smallest hesitation, believe it to be so. So I think that really speaks to what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Pope Pius XII says it explicitly in Divino Afflante Spiritu. He basically says, look, the purpose of sacred scripture is to give sacred truths necessary for salvation. The purpose of the empirical sciences is to give an empirical mathematical explanation of the physical world. Okay. Now, if you just use, you know, when you stay in the lane, you use physical, scientific methodology to prove physical and scientific conclusions, perfectly good thing to do. And of course, if you use you know, biblical hermeneutics, the doctrines of the Catholic Church, and so forth, to interpret sacred scripture, you're going to come up with those truths that are necessary for salvation. They don't have to conflict at all.
Excellent. Father, thank you for all this. And thanks for, like, quote unquote, letting us get into the weeds, because I think a lot of people are thinking about these things. A lot of young people who are learning things in high school, college, and yet have learned about the scriptures, don't know how to bring those together into a conversation. And obviously you're very, very well versed in all of it. So we're really grateful that you could be with us. Before we go, tell us a little bit about this new book and where our listeners can find it and how it can really help them in their own desire to, let's say, become like mini theologians, which is really just faith seeking understanding, right? So they have a belief and they want to understand. So how can your book help them?
Yeah. So, Father Switzer's Universe, you know, exploring the big questions there. It's published by, both EWTN and Sophia Press, co-published there. And it's like a Reader's Digest version of a lot of Father Switzer's stuff. So what I would say is, if you're interested in the faith and science evidence for God, things of that nature we were discussing at the beginning, if you're interested in evolution, the question we were talking about, you know, today as well, if you're interested in, you know, well, why does the church teach against, transgenderism? Is there any case that can be made from purely secular, social, scientific, psychological surveys and explanations for why this is a terrible idea and why it not only leads to spiritual decline, but to, you know, damaged emotional health and relational health? There's tons of evidence for that. So I talk about that. I talk about abortion, the recent arguments, in that area. Certainly talking about, you know, the transubstantiation, the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, how to understand it from the vantage point of Christ. So what I try to do in one little volume is to give a Reader's Digest version of, you know, about 30 of the big question areas that come up on my program, Father Switzer's Universe, and then, you know, trying to just take like a representative question where Doug Keck and I are interacting. But, you know, basically gives, you know, like, what about this evolution thing, or what about the real presence? How could you possibly justify, you know, that when you look under the microscope and you see still bread molecules, you know, how can that be, you know, a substantial change?
Do you talk about the shroud in there too, Father?
I talk a lot about the Shroud of Turin. I talk about the recent studies of near-death experiences and terminal lucidity indicating, you know, life after death from a peer-reviewed medical point of view, and a variety of other things, you know, including Lonergan's philosophical proof for God's existence. I mean, we didn't even get into the new stuff on philosophy today, but there's some great new philosophical proofs of God that are out there. I just saw brand new quantum physics proof of God from a guy named Steve Priest over at Oxford. Really excellent thing that's been done there. So there's just a lot of new fruits of God and, that are out, philosophical, scientific.
So Father, it sounds like this is a great book to like really get introduced to all the different things you like to talk about and have gone into deeper. So like if somebody's really interested in all of these different topics or in some of them, pick up this book, read through it. And then when you want to go deeper into a particular one, I would say this is almost like a trailer or a teaser trailer to each one of these topics. Then you can go like deeper by going to the Magis Center, going to your other books, and really go deep, because you do go deep on your website. So that's fantastic. So does that sound about right?
That sounds right. I mean, like I said, Reader's Digest version on about 30 questions.
Awesome. Father, this has been great fun. I really appreciate your knowledge, your insight. I've enjoyed spending this time with you. And thank you for all that you're doing for our Lord, for his church. And let us continue to pray for one another and encourage one another, okay?
Thanks, Dr. Haydock. Great to be with you again.
All right. God bless.
God bless.
In addition to producing this podcast, A Ray of Hope is also known for producing events such as retreats, missions, conferences, and concerts. If you'd like to learn more about what we offer, just go to our website and click on Experience. There you can see and learn all the various programs that we offer. God bless you, and we hope to see you soon.